you've got this theme of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and this book based on some lectures of Bhante Sangharakshita called The Inconceivable Emancipation, which is an alternative title for this ancient Buddhist text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the exposition of Vimalakirti, which is also known as the purification of the Buddha field. These old Buddhist sutras often have many different names that which sort of draw out different aspects of the sutra. And it's one of my favourite sutras, and this is one of my favourite books of Sangharakshita. It's an extremely rich sutra. It's full of different kinds of Buddhist instructions, from very basic Buddhism to the most sort of mind-bogglingly metaphysical, with an awful lot of drama in it and humour. It's quite an amusing sutra in places, and a lot of magic, all centering around the main character in the sutra, Vimalakirti, who's a householder, but lives like a religious devotee, as the sutra has it, lives in this very, very sort of pure way. He appears to lead the life of a layman, but nobody knows where his family is or anything like that. It's a very, very mysterious character. And he is the embodiment of what's known as upaya kaushalya, skillful means, inconceivable skillful means. Skillful means is really the beginning, the coming together of wisdom and compassionate activity. Wisdom and compassionate activity. It's highly attuned communication that communicates in the most precise fashion possible for every single individual. This is what Vimalakirti particularly embodies, and there's all sorts of stories about that, and I'm sure you're going to get to that at some point in your series. But the concern tonight is this phrase, this task of building the Buddha land, which is the opening of the sutra, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, which just features the Buddha. I said just features the Buddha and a huge gathering of different kinds of human beings, men and women, but great bodhisattvas, all different kinds of gods, enlightened beings. I can't sort of list off all the different sort of figures that are there. And the Buddha begins his discourse on what's called the Bodhisattva's purification of the Buddha field. The Bodhisattva's purification of the Buddha field. So we're getting into the arcana of Mahayana Buddhist doctrine here. But the basic idea is that one of the tasks of someone who's taken a vow to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, one of their main tasks is to purify a Buddha field, or rather to create, to make a world that is perfectly conducive to the attainment of enlightenment. To create a world where it's easy to grow and develop, to transform all the way to full and perfect liberation, to Buddhahood itself. It's a very interesting notion in Mahayana Buddhism, and you might have come across in your studies and in your reading the whole notion of Sakavati. We actually have a community upstairs called Sakavati, the land of bliss. Well, the land of bliss is a Buddha field created by a bodhisattva called Amitabha's the Buddha. He had a different name when he was a bodhisattva. Dharmakara, thank you, full marks for that. I didn't know. But there's this wonderful world created by the Buddha Amitabha. You arrive there, you're born from a lotus, and all you have to do is listen to the teachings of Amitabha, which is coming from the trees, coming from the birds, coming from everywhere. That's all you've got to do. You're in this absolutely perfect world. And so there's this whole idea that one of the tasks, your main task as a Buddhist committed to not just your own practice, but committed to helping others on the path, is to create a world perfectly conducive to Dharma practice, to spiritual practice. So let's just pause a bit and see how we can sort of relate to that. It sounds sort of fantastic. And in the sutra, it says, the Buddha says, that it is possible for a bodhisattva to create out of nothing a world like that. Apparently it is possible to do that with the power of consciousness. Wouldn't that be amazing, you know, that suddenly we're with somebody who has that power and they can, as it were, transport us to an entirely different dimension in which we can actually easily practice the Dharma. But as Sangha actually points out in his lecture, that once we were in it, we probably would start to feel a bit dissatisfied. We wouldn't be entirely comfortable just being with our lotus and the teachings of the Buddha. We'd want to bring our televisions in, and in those days in his lecture series there weren't smartphones and so on, but it would be all the technology. And he tells this very lovely old Indian story of the woman who sells fish at the market. It gets late, she doesn't, it takes a long time for her to sell all her fish. It's too late to go home, so she asks her friend, the flower seller, if she can sleep in his flower stall overnight. And she can't sleep. She's tossing and turning amidst these wonderful flowers, the marigolds and the roses and the jasmine, all those lovely fresh-cut Indian flowers. She just can't sleep amidst these beautiful flowers. So she pulls her fish basket under her nose, then she can sleep. The stink of fish is very, very comforting. She's used to that. She's not used to the sweet smells. So we're a bit like that. We might be in a wonderful retreat setting that Akasha Mitra mentioned, but after a while we might start to get a bit restless, even though the conditions are perfect. We might start to find fault with what's going on. And so on and so forth. But nonetheless, it's certainly true, as Akasha Mitra was saying earlier, it's often very difficult to keep up a Buddhist practice amidst all the challenges and demands of everyday life, especially in a city like London. It's really, really hard. I know it's really, really hard. I've done question and answers here sometimes where, you know, I've been talking about the Dharma, about the way to practice, and people have said almost sort of despairingly how it's just so hard to sustain a meditation practice when you've got to get up early, you've got to travel far on overcrowded trains and buses and all the rest of it. You've got a job that's very demanding. You come home, even rushing to the meditation class at the Buddhist Center creates its own sort of challenges, and so on and so forth. It's difficult. So we do need to start affecting our environment. Yes, Buddhist practice in the end is about taking responsibility for ourselves, transforming our own life and mind. But in order to do that effectively, we've also got to start working on changing and transforming and remaking and rebuilding the world around us and the communities around us. It's that both are important. In doing that, you have to develop other qualities within yourself. In creating these other environments, something very positive develops in you. This whole project of converting this old fire station into a Buddhist center had the strong inspiration of building the Buddha land, wanting to create environments within this place which are conducive to our own individual practice. So yes, it's not simply that we can just rest content with working on our mind. Sooner or later, if we're going to make any real progress, really substantial progress in Buddhist practice, we have to start affecting our environment. And in turn, the change in the environment that having an effect on ourselves. There's a sort of dialectical relationship between the two. So tonight I want to give you five precepts for building the Buddha land. I seem to be in the mood for giving talks at the moment where I give four or five precepts. I kind of like that idea in a talk. So the five sort of maxims in this case, headings, if you like, which maybe you, if you like the material, you'll remember and you can go away with and use. So the five precepts for building the Buddha land are: make yourself. Secondly, gather wisdom. Thirdly, make friends. Fourthly, make a world together. And fifthly, revere the mystery. So I'm just going to go through these one by one, and we'll see what we make of them, see what you make of them. So first of all, make yourself. Make yourself. The whole vision of building a Buddha land is, in many ways, it's an act of supreme creativity. Supreme creativity. It's as if the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, is the supreme artist. That's the sort of vision of things, the supreme artist, creating an incredibly beautiful world of meaning and value, which will be so uplifting for the beings within it that they have to do, it's very, very easy to make progress. I mean, that's an act of supreme creativity. And really, creativity is one of those words in our own Tri Ratna these days. It's a bit tired from overuse in many ways, but that is actually what the Buddhist life really is about. It's about creating. It's about creating. It's about making. Reading a very interesting study at the moment of Sir Thomas Wyatt, a courtier in the court of Henry VIII, who was a very great poet, and he's described as a maker. This old kind of Elizabethan or pre-Elizabethan idea, even Renaissance idea, that a poet and an artist are makers. They are makers. And what we're doing with our Buddhist life is making ourselves, remaking ourselves. Really, we don't have a lot of choice about this. If we, with our lives, that the thing is, you know, the Buddhist vision of human beings is entirely dynamic. In Buddhism, there is no fixed and unchanging self or essence or anything like that, or unchanging sort of soul. It doesn't mean there isn't a sort of deeper dimension to us, a kind of, there isn't heart and, you know, all those things, using that sort of language very poetically. But there is nothing that resists change and transformation. Everything is in process, and the whether we like it or not, we are making ourselves. This is related to the notion of the law of karma, which you might have come across. The law of karma. The law of karma is basically saying our intentional actions lead to our future. If you know the Dhammapada, you'll know that the first two verses of the Dhammapada are really describing that. I've got them written down here, I'll just read them to you. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and made by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox, drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. These are extremely important verses. And there they are, right at the beginning of probably the most famous Buddhist text. It's making it very clear that our own life, our own world even, is entirely within our hands. There's no appeal to an exterior deity or to fate or to chance or anything like that. We make, we shape, we remake our lives constantly. If we act with what the text calls impurity, out of unskillful states of craving and hatred and aversion, that's just going to lead to a life of toil, of suffering. That incredible image of the wheel following the hoof of the ox. We're just making these deep ruts in our lives. This is very habitual, very repetitive, very depressing, really. And in the end, really, really hard work. The sort of Buddhist vision of what is called the samsara is that it's really, really hard work. It's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting. We make that. We make that. And we can make a different self, if you like, in the future, to use that sort of language, a different us, by acting out of a pure mind, a skillful mind, out of, well, not just non-greed, non-craving, but contentment and generosity, not just out of non-hatred, but loving-kindness, metta, compassion, generosity, and out of understanding and wisdom and non-confusion. That will lead to us, our happiness and well-being, and that happiness will be like a shadow that never departs. It's an interesting image. That means we're walking in the light. That means we're walking in light. And the shadow is something like, as it were, an aura that we're carrying all the time. It's interesting, the word for purity here is a word related to faith and trust and a sense of something higher. The word for impurity in the verse before is interesting. It literally means spoilt, which I think is rather good. We when we sort of, as it were, let ourselves down, we spoil our lives. It's not to do with being sort of sinful or evil. We spoil a possible future. Whereas we act out of faith and confidence and knowing and a sense of a higher purpose and meaning, that's going to create this other reality of light moving forward creatively. So these verses, right at the beginning of the Dhammapada, are making it clear that the Buddhist life begins with deciding to remake ourselves. Deciding to remake ourselves. Another way of putting it, we take responsibility for our lives. We take responsibility for our lives. Yes, I know very well, living at Padmaloka, I listen to a lot of people's life stories. It's incredible, you know, that some people are still standing, let alone finding their way to Buddhism. Really, really tough starts in life. You know, difficult family situations, wrong paths taken, leaving to sort of catastrophic events. I mean, I really do feel very, very fortunate. But the thing is, it doesn't matter, in a sense, what has happened to you. Of course it matters. But the only way to go forward is to take charge, is to take full charge of your life. It's very interesting, the following verses in the Dhammapada are all about blame. They're all about giving up blame and resentment. Those who entertain such thoughts that he abused me, he beat me, he robbed me, he conquered me, will not still their hatred. Very, very clear. And then it goes on, as the verses go on, to emphasise loving kindness and so on in different ways. Very, very strong teaching. Rather irritating teaching. I often find it, I get annoyed with Buddhism sometimes because you can't do jihad on people. Do inner jihad, you know, that's fine, which is, according to Muhammad, the greater jihad is internal, not external. But anyway, that's another matter. But you have to recreate the whole business of Buddhist life is really making and remaking yourself constantly and not giving yourself any outs. You know, you can't justify hatred. You can't justify violence. You can't say he or she made me do this. You have to take moral responsibility. And you have to get over that idea that you've just sort of been thrown into life. I think it's Heidegger says somewhere that he uses this notion of thrownness. The experience of so many people in modern life is that we're just sort of thrown here, almost arbitrarily. And I think that's how a lot of people feel. I think he's got a bit of an insight there. But Buddhist tradition says, okay, if you feel that you're thrown here, that doesn't matter. You have to shape your life. You have to go forward. You've really got no choice but to really get down to taking responsibility for yourself. Take up, if you're serious about Buddhism, take up Buddhist practice of ethics, meditation, wisdom. Really take hold of yourself. There really is no other alternative. And I think it's very important to stress this in a talk on building the Buddha land, or in a series where you're talking a lot about, you know, the ideal society or the ideal world or the ideal Sangha. Because unless you really understand that the start of Buddhist life is taking responsibility of yourself, for yourself, making yourself, remaking yourself, it's very easy to turn the Sangha, the community, into something about that should be giving something to you. That can very, very easily happen. You can start thinking that the friends in your Sangha aren't good enough, your teachers aren't good enough, the centre isn't good enough. And before you know it, you've ended up, well, the Buddha isn't good enough, and so on and so forth. And, you know, you end up not really doing anything with your life and just drifting, which a lot of people do. A lot of people spend their time going from group to group, religion to religion, technique to technique, not realizing that the first place they need to start is themselves. In a sense, it doesn't really matter what you do, providing it's skillful, ethical. So long as you really do it, you really take it up. There's a great saying, which I often quote, probably quoted here more than once, samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. You know, the world of repetitive, suffering life is the tendency to find fault with others. So I guess you could say the opposite. Nirvana is the tendency to find virtue in others, to find quality in others, in all others. So we start with this, remaking ourselves, taking full responsibility for ourselves. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, one of my favourite passages occurs quite early on. Vimalakirti, one of the things he does, he manifests sickness, that's the way the text puts it, in order to teach people the Dharma. Because when a great person is sick in India, a great sort of leader of the community, everybody gathers. They're all really concerned. They're all going to gather outside of their house, you know, to make sure they're okay. So Vimalakirti, in order to attract people, manifest sickness. Actually, he really is sick. It goes with embodiment. And he's asked about his sickness and the condition of his body. And he gives this incredible teaching. I mean, it's a really, really strong teaching on the nature of the body. I think the discourse, the homily on the body begins with, friends, this body is so impermanent, unworthy of confidence. And he goes through, you know, all of the aspects of the body, really revealing its impermanence and the certainty of its death and passing, using quite vivid imagery. It's very, very, very powerful meditation, harking back to the Buddha's teachings on the body. But it's essentially a teaching in impermanence on the illusory nature of the body and the fact that it will get sick, it will let you down, that it's not a refuge, a source of security. And instead of relying on this body, of course, Vimalakirti is not saying you don't rely on it to the extent that you can rely on it, but he says you need to be directing your aspirations to the development of what he calls the Tathagatakaya, the body of the Buddha. And the body of the Buddha is born of the great Buddhist practices. It's born of the practice of ethics. It's born of meditation. It's born of wisdom. It's born of the practice of the precepts. It's born of generosity. It's born of ethics and patience and energy. It's a wonderful teaching, because what it's saying is that all this Buddhist practice that we're engaged in is building something. It's giving birth to something. And I think that's important, that it's important to try and really visualize, if you like, our future Buddhahood, even. That's what he's saying. And you direct your aspirations, he says. In other words, you go for refuge, you commit, you put all your energy into the creation of this enlightened body, this collection of qualities. And of course, this is one of the reasons why we have the Buddha images, why we have all the great, you know, Buddhist art. It's to give us a vivid picture of the Buddha body and the qualities that we're aspiring to develop. So this is this first business of this first precept of to do with building the Buddha land. Make yourself, all those committed to creating a Buddha land must first of all really get down to making and remaking themselves. A spiritual community, a sangha, is made up of all those who are concerned with, committed to, making and remaking themselves first and foremost, and taking full responsibility for that. So that needs to be the very basis of everything. And like I say, I want to emphasise this, because it's all too easy to find fault with other people within our sangha and our spiritual communities and in our centres and so on and so forth. And, you know, we must be very, very careful not to spend our time doing that. It doesn't mean that people are perfect. Of course they're not. And if things need to be sorted out, you have to sort them out. But they're on the basis of taking full responsibility for oneself, of creating and recreating oneself. Supremely important. And secondly, sort of coming out of this, I've used this expression, gather wisdom. It's no good trying to build a Buddha field if you don't have any wisdom. And I'm deliberately using the word wisdom, not the word insight or, you know, transcendental wisdom or something like that. We have to realize that a big part of Buddhist practice is learning, not academic learning, as Jnanavacha said, but there are things to learn. There are things to learn. There is a different vision to open up to. One of the things that we need to recognise is how deeply conditioned we are by the views and the opinions and attitudes of the world around us, which are very often unexamined. You know, there's so many things which we assume are sort of absolute truth, and are the way things are, which actually are antithetical to Buddhist practice. It's very, very interesting. And the only way you can undo that is by exposing yourself to wisdom, by exposing yourself to the Buddha's teaching. It's the only way you can actually start to see, you know, your unanalyzed views and opinions, which actually hold you back, which actually restrict you and limit you. And the Buddhist path in terms of wisdom is definitely seen as a progression. You don't go straight to it. Sometimes you can have a glimpse, even before you become a Buddhist, a glimpse of sort of perfect vision into the true nature of things, which sort of opens things up, which does break through the kind of assumptions that you have about life. But even if you have that, you've still got to enter into a training. And the traditional way in which wisdom develops is, they say, through hearing or learning, through reflecting, and through making it a living experience. So, first of all, there's the wisdom that comes through hearing. If you want to learn Buddhism, there has to be some receptivity. There has to be some openness to what is being taught. I mean, presumably that's there in you, because you wouldn't be here otherwise. You've made the effort to turn up tonight. That's, you know, so presumably there is something that you're interested in learning about Buddhism, about the Dharma, about Buddhist practice. But you need to really sort of take it in. Sometimes I think, you know, in the world of, for want of a better term, the sort of spiritual world in the modern West, sometimes things seem to be presented that you go for the maximum experience with the minimum amount of effort. That seems to be the way it's sort of presented, especially if you don't have to leave your room even. You can click on to somebody giving a talk and bang, you're enlightened, you know, within an hour or something. So maximum experience, max out on experience, minimum amount of engagement. Buddhist teaching doesn't go like that, traditionally. That's not the way you learn. You know, traditionally, if you really, you know, want to learn from a master in a community, from a teacher in a community, you spend a lot of time qualifying. You know, being waiting out traditionally in the snow or knocking on the door, and even then the teacher might refuse to teach you. A lot of the time in monasteries, you're told that first thing you have to do is spend a lot of time working in the kitchens. In Zen monasteries, apparently, this is the first place that you're sent. You've just got to work. You've got to pound rice. You've got to cut vegetables. You've got to clean the place. This is all part of learning. This is all part of learning. And yes, there'll be a teaching every so often. You know, and no doubt you'll take it a lot more seriously because it's happening in a context where you've really put yourself out, where you've had to sort of go a long way. You've had to, you're not just, you know, being given it immediately. You've got to sort of pick up on the whole ethos of the community. It's very, very important. So, you know, I know here at the centre there's quite a lot of requests for volunteers, you know, to help out cooking on retreats and, you know, organising retreats and cleaning the centre. That is part of gathering wisdom. That is part of actually learning. I mean, very often friends of mine say about living at Padmaloka that they learn more from, you know, as much from, or even more from the study groups than in the sort of day-to-day interactions that go on between people. The day-to-day interactions, the sort of the issues that come up, as it were, you know, when you interact with people, even when you fall out of it with people, or learning to cooperate with people that you don't particularly want to cooperate with. That's one of the ways in which you learn and gather wisdom. But of course, it's also very important to study, to actually study the teachings. We put a lot of emphasis on study in our own Sangha. We have a Dharma training course for those who get more deeply involved. And, you know, you every week you spend going through a text with somebody more experienced and with a group of people, really trying to understand, what is this text actually saying? What are the implications of that for my life? That's where it's starting to turn into making it, you know, a source of reflection. What are the implications of this teaching for me and my life? You might even start to see the disparity between what the Buddha is saying and your habitual behaviour. And then out of that, it becomes a living experience. The wisdom starts to turn into life practice. So, yes, gather wisdom. We can't have a Buddha land unless there is real wisdom within it. It's not just some sort of groovy utopia, you know, where we turn up completely unregenerated with all sorts of sloppy thinking and, you know, just plain, you know, dogma, you know, the dogmas of modern life. That's not the way this works. We need to have some real ballast, if you like, some real wisdom, some real knowing, tremendously important. And of course, one of the things that's going to start to become clearer and clearer through the gathering of wisdom, there are a number of things. Sometimes when we talk about wisdom, when Buddhists talk about wisdom, they can get very kind of metaphysical. You know, this is where Zen Buddhism, I think, is quite good, because you try and be metaphysical with a Zen master, you'll probably get a slap, traditionally. there's that great koan, isn't there? Koan, that story, that public case of that great Chan Master Yun Men, where he's asked, what is the talk? What is the teaching? What is the Dharma that goes beyond Buddhas and patriarchs? So what is the teaching that transcends enlightenment, the Buddhas and the patriarchs, the great Chan masters? Yun Men's reply, cake. Cake. And there's a completely mind-boggling commentary on what the meaning of cake actually means. The best bit of it was, even the cake stuffed in doesn't stop the talking. As if what Yun Men is saying, what he's really trying to say, I want to stuff a cake right in your mouth. So thank goodness for these Zen masters, because they want to just get away from the metaphysics. There is a kind of ordinary, everyday wisdom. You find it in the Dhammapada. You know, this sort of almost street wisdom that we need to be getting hold of first of all. I mean, these first two verses from the Dhammapada to do with karma. We need that wisdom. That's much more to the point, or the wisdom of, you know, where the Buddha says, the others, in other words, those not really practicing a true Dharma life, the others do not realize that we are all heading for death. Those who do realize it will end their quarrels. That's tremendous. That's that. When I first heard that verse, I thought the Buddha must be enlightened. He must be enlightened. There's nothing about emptiness or not self or illusory nature. No. When you know that you're going to die, you will stop quarreling. You will harmonize with others. You will develop loving kindness to others. You know that life is too short and too uncertain, you know, to waste time in quarreling and battling. That's a tremendous wisdom. That's the kind of wisdom that we need. So it's very important to remember that sort of street wisdom, as it were, which is far from street, isn't it? It transcends the street, the transcendental street. But, of course, there is also this great emphasis on, yes, the illusory, pliable nature of life. That's how we can make and remake ourselves, seeing impermanence, insubstantiality, seeing that everything is like a wonderful magician's illusion. Everything is actually a creative display. Very important to have that, to have the inklings of that, that there is nothing fixed and unchanging. And there's a wonderful teaching on this in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where there's a dialogue. There's a lot of dialogue, as I hope you'll hear about during this course of teachings you've got on the Vimalakirti Nidesha. A lot of dialogue between Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He's the only person who's prepared to go and see how Vimalakirti is. The Buddha's asked various people to go. They're all scared because they've all had interactions with Vimalakirti where they've been humiliated. He's so wise and so on it. Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, he goes. And he asks a question of Vimalakirti. He asks the question, how should a Bodhisattva view all living beings? How should a Bodhisattva see people? You know, if you're going to build the Buddha land, what's your attitude to others? We've been looking at the attitude to ourself, as it were, but what's the attitude to others? And he gives this, again, this incredible teaching on that he should see everybody as like a magician's illusion. And he goes through many similes of living beings, that all of us are, yes, illusory, insubstantial, like a mirage, a rainbow, arising and passing. You'd think that that's a rather nihilistic view, but it's not in the Buddhist tradition. It's actually a sense of wonder, sort of the wonderful manifestations of life arising and passing, seeing into this unfixed nature. Having done that, having given this incredible teaching, Manjushri then asks, but then how does, or what is, how is the Bodhisattva's great love for living beings? And it's one of the most beautiful passages in all of Buddhist literature, as far as I'm concerned, where Vimalakirti tells Manjushri and everybody present what the great love, the Mahamaitri, the Mahametta, is. He just goes through all these different descriptions of what love is, what loving kindness really is for all beings. He says something like, just as I've experienced the Dharma myself, just as I've experienced reality, so must I communicate it to all living beings. So he develops the great love, which is truly a refuge for all living beings. Wonderful expression, that telling us that what loving kindness that we're communicating to others is something protective, something absolutely reliable. That's what we're looking to do in our metta bhavana, if you didn't realize it. We're looking to develop an absolutely reliable loving kindness, not just to our friends, but to everybody. He goes on and talks about developing, I can't go into all the different kinds of love that he describes, but one of the favourite ones I have, he develops the love, the Bodhisattva develops the love, which is the Bodhisattva's love, which continuously matures and ripens living beings. So loving kindness is what brings about the growth of others, their enfoldment and transformation and change. So you can see from this sort of passage that there's no kind of conflict between wisdom, seeing the unfixed nature of all of life, and a loving kindness, which is taking the unfixed nature of us and bringing about the flourishing of that life. That's what Vimalakirti communicates. And of course, if we're going to build this Buddha land, we need to be developing that kind of love, that protective, nurturing love, which is also brings about people's awakening, their enlightenment. It's an amazing passage. So this brings me to the third of the precepts for building the Buddha land, which are called make friends. Make friends. It's a lovely idiom in our English language. We don't talk about grabbing friends or getting friends. The idiom is making friends. And we make friends out of our loving kindness. We make friends out of making love, out of making metta. That's how we make friends. Sometimes, and it's very sad when you hear it, sometimes people feel that they don't have any friends. They feel lonely in the end of it. They might have people they socialise with, they might have family and colleagues, but sometimes at night, perhaps alone in their bed in the middle of the night, they can feel terribly lonely. Not just alone, but deeply lonely, that there's no one to really share in the heights, the depths, really, that they can really talk to and really communicate with, and even just share their own love. I think sometimes a lot of the sort of suffering that people have and frustration is because they can't actually express love to somebody, loving kindness to somebody. You ever had that feeling, what a relief it is when you can really express love, very clean love, not a love where you want something, not an infatuation. I mean, straightforward, friendly, kindly love. You know, where you really see that person, you love them for what they are. It's such a wonderful feeling when you can express that, when you can live that. I think there's a lot of frustrated lovers in this world, and you know, I know depression is one of the big things nowadays. I think I sometimes wonder if actually a lot of depression is to do with the repression of the positive. It's not murky, horrible, dark, smelly stuff that's often repressed. It's often very, very positive, creative, uplifting emotion that people haven't had the chance to to really express. So we need to have the courage to make friends. And of course, when you take up metta bhavana, and that's the basis, you know, when you nurture that loving kindness, that friendly love, what starts to happen? You do start to make friends. It is a kind of magic practice. I know a lot of people find it very, very difficult. I think you have, do you still do your courses here? Or who hates the metta bhavana? Yeah, who hates the metta bhavana? Because it's such a sort of problem for you. I love the metta bhavana. I mean, I don't mean I'm very good at it, but I love doing the metta bhavana. I love sitting there kind of trying to generate, you know, loving kindness and all the rest of it. I think it's an absolutely wonderful practice. But of course, it's not just something you do on your cushion. It's important to consciously, without being too self-conscious, to make friends, to go out to people, to spend time with people. And it's such a big feature of our Sri Ratna community. We put a lot of emphasis on friendship. Friendliness, and out of friendliness, the fruit of that is friendships, not exclusive friendships, but friendships which are expansive and inclusive. It does so many things for you, friendship. Of course, yes, you won't feel so lonely. You'll feel that you're able to share, you know, your life much more fully. There's this wonderful insight. I think it's Cicero eventually who originally had this insight, but it's taken up by others. Cicero says something like, a friend is another self. I think that's a fantastic insight, actually. You know, I'm blessed by some very close friends, and I feel very fortunate in that. And, you know, with some of those friends, I can articulate my most private and sort of secret thoughts and experiences, not, you know, dark stuff, but also, you know, more intimate sort of spiritual things, because that person is both me and not me. They are another self. I think that's what a friend can be. I think it is interesting that traditionally in the West, in the classical world, friendship was always written about by the great classical writers. I think we're trying to, in our own movement, to bring about a kind of renaissance of such friendships. And of course, there's another aspect to it. It's a friendship based upon Buddhist practice, based upon something that, as it were, transcends us as individuals, that does bring about community. Without making such friendships, you can't have a Buddha land. You know, imagine coming here and it was a really cold place where people weren't friendly. I mean, very often people sort of say, oh, one of the great things about, I often hear it from people who've gone away from Sri Ratna to other Buddhist groups or something like that. And I bump into them and they say, it's good, I'm enjoying the teaching's important, but there isn't anything like the friendliness and friendship that you have in Sri Ratna. And I often say, well, that's not a mistake. You know, it's not a sort of, that is, that it's not as if, that it's not just by chance that we have a strong culture of friendship. It's actually coming out of a vision of life. It's actually coming out of seeing the importance of Dharma practice transcending self and other. It's not just about oneself. It has to start flowing into relationship and being open to others. So friendship is tremendously important, and a community characterized by love and friendship. You can't have a Buddha land without it. And you notice it when as your friendships develop within the Sangha, the changes that happen in you and the changes in your friends. Sometimes it's hard to separate each other out. I think that's my experience at Padmaloka very strongly, where I've lived together with a number of people for a very, very long time. And very often, you know, people are very grateful to what we give or what I give. And I'm very, very clear in my own mind that would not be possible without the community of friends that I'm a part of at Padmaloka, and more widely within our community. It's very, very hard to kind of isolate something, a quality, just in one's own self. It really doesn't seem like that to me. You know, that without what others are doing and what I'm doing with others, they just weren't, whatever, you know, the virtues, just such as they are, just would not be there. They would not be happening. So making friends. You know, you could have the most beautiful Buddhist centre, you know, which is just really aesthetically wonderful. But unless you've got a community of friends, a wider community of friends within it, and a culture of friendship, it would be like a hospital without doctors. That's what it would be like. It really would. It would be useless. I remember in India, when I lived for a while, I went with, when we first started things in India, when Tri Ratna first started there with Lokamitra, Sangharakshita came. It was his sort of return visit. And he gave these wonderful, big public lectures, you know, to thousands of people. I'd never seen anything like it. And we were very poor. There were just a few of us. We didn't have really any money. We were sort of borrowing, and I won't say stealing, but doing it. We had the places where we had to teach the Dharma. It wasn't stealing, but there was a disused bungalow in Pune that we used on Sunday mornings. And I think that one of the Indian order members, you know, slipped a few rupees to the watchman of the bungalow, so we could just use this veranda to have a meditation class. We had to just use anything we could get. We managed to get a garage in a Christian house because the car was out at church on a Sunday morning, and the order member who managed to arrange for this place said yes, and we will be teaching birth control in the classes. I mean, we didn't, but I mean, that's a fib, wasn't it? Skillful means. But anyway, they obviously weren't Catholics. We didn't have a big centre, we didn't have a big temple or anything like that. And of course, in India, if you're, those sorts of things count for a lot if you've got a big, prestigious place, and we just didn't have the resources for that at that time. And Sangharakshita, in one of his talks, said, look, some of you might be wondering why we haven't built a really big place. He didn't mention anything about not having any money. He said, well, what we're doing is, and he's right, we're building up community. We're building up Sangha. We're building up a community of friends, so that when we do get a place like that, it really will have the right spirit. He said exactly the same thing about building this place, converting this place. He said he was really glad that there wasn't some big foundation putting in loads of money so that we could just turn up and teach Buddhism. It was good that we had to build and rebuild the place and do that, because in doing that, we were going to learn how to run it. We were going to learn how to be a community so that we could then learn how to run the place. So make friends. Make friends. If you want to change the world around you, make friends in whatever way you can and develop loving kindness. I do the Metta Bhavana pretty much every day for this reason. It's sort of a main Dharma practice for me. I need to. I'm too sort of far too emotional for my own good. So I actually need to do it. And even if you aren't emotional, well, that's another good reason to do the Metta Bhavana every day. But I would really recommend getting to grips with that practice and really putting into practice in daily life. Make friends. And then the next one, and I should finish soon, make a world together. Make a world together. This is really sort of bringing us to the heart of the matter, really, of building the Buddha land. As a group of friends, you then have to start bodying forth a world. I mean, in a way, I don't really have to say very much, because that's what's happened here. Really, it was a group of friends who moved into the old fire station, which was a burnt out hulk of a building, which the London Borough of Tower Hamlets at the time really didn't know what to do with. So it was a group of friends who, you know, came in and managed to convince the Labour councillors of the time that they could do something with it. And they did. We did. That's what a group of friends then does. Out of that strong sense of friendship, you create a world. You create a world. Now, there could be all sorts of projects that you get involved with to do that. It's not just about, you know, you have to keep doing it and redoing it. The even this place is still being remade, rebuilt in different ways. It would be good if we had more space, more property. I'm sure that's in people's minds because, you know, the place is bursting at the seams. There's the retreat centre at Vadrasana. That's a world that's created, but it doesn't have to be on that scale. You know, it might be the sort of thing that you and a group of friends, you create some sort of environment which people can come into, and in coming into that environment, they change. I can't sort of think of examples. It might be an outreach project with a, you know, teaching meditation in another part of London or something like that. It could in principle be anything. It'd be a cultural project of some kind or another. I mean, you have to sort of fill in the blanks, really. But when you start to make a world together, when you start to interact with bricks and mortar and, you know, with the institutions of the world, the challenges really come. The challenges really come. When you start to body forth your Buddhist practice, when you really try to do something, you start to come up against a lot of things which are harder to change and transform. I've been reflecting quite a lot lately on how things have sort of changed in the world in relation to our own Buddhist movement. I mean, the fact that we could get this place goes back to an age in the 1970s where I would say society was far less regulated than it is now. Things are incredibly regulated, incredibly sort of controlled, and incredibly expensive. I was living in squats back in the 1970s in North London. You know, we could take over these places, do something with them, change the kind of, you know, vibe around the atmosphere around a place sort of fairly easily. Could live on very, very little. It's much more demanding now, I think, to create an environment, to create a world. All the more reason why we have to do it. It needs a lot of ingenuity, it needs a lot of talent, a lot of skills. One of the wonderful things about Tree Ratman these days is the sort of range of skills and talents and abilities that are involved in our Sangha. And I think if you're serious about living a Buddhist life with others, I'm serious about wanting to create environments. Start talking to the order members in this centre and the people involved and see what you can do to be a part of that, to creating these environments. I'm going to finish with the last point, and that is revere the mystery. Revere the mystery. My talk has been, I hope it's been practical, useful, whatever. But in a way, it's probably been a bit prosaic in some ways, because there does need to be an element in all this where in building the Buddha land, there's something about these Buddha lands in the Buddhist tradition which are inconceivable, transcendent, beyond conception, magical. That has to be part of our Buddhist life. That sort of, you know, the one of the things I find really sort of irritating, again, it seems to be more prevalent than everybody wants to know the sort of the cash value of everything, the sort of the practical application of everything immediately. It's very, people find it very hard just to bow their head and revere that which that can't be contained and, in a sense, understood. And one of my favourite passages in the Vimalakirti Nidesha is the passage called The Goddess. There's this chapter, I hope you do this chapter, the goddess, the Devi. She doesn't have a name, this goddess. She just suddenly turns up. In fact, she lives in Vimalakirti's house. She just lives there. We don't know what she looks like. We don't know what colour she is. She's just this nameless Devi, this goddess, this other. Don't think that that means that she's a woman or anything like that. She transcends gender, I would say. She's just the Devi, just the goddess. She's lived for 12 years. Why 12? Why 12 years? What's 12 got to do with it? But 12 years in Vimalakirti's house. And she's a sort of, she testifies to the fact that Vimalakirti in this house of miracles, his house, which apparently can expand to contain the entire cosmos without shrinking all the other houses in the great city of Vaishali, has that kind of magic quality. She says that the goddess says, well, in this house, there's only been the teaching of the Dharma for the liberation of all living beings. It's the only way this man, Vimalakirti, teaches. But she says other things. She talks about 8 qualities in this house. So let me just mention the 8 strange and wonderful things that manifest themselves constantly in Vimalakirti's house. Vimalakirti's house actually seems to be a Buddha land within the wider world, a sort of place to go, where a house to go to, which is, well, wonderful. Listen. A light of golden hue shines here constantly, so bright that it is hard to distinguish day and night, and neither the moon nor the sun shines here distinctly. Whoever enters this house, human or non-human, is no longer troubled by their passions. From the moment they are within, all their troubles disappear. This house is never forsaken by the great gods Chakra, Brahma, the protectors of the world, and the bodhisattvas from other Buddha fields. This house is never empty of the sounds of the Dharma, the discourse on the 6 perfections, and the discourses of the irreversible wheel of the Dharma. In this house, one always hears the drums, the rhythms, the songs, and music of gods and humans. From this music constantly resounds the sound of the infinite Dharma of the Buddha. In this house, there are always 4 inexhaustible treasures, replete with all kinds of jewels, which never decrease, although all the poor and wretched may partake to their satisfaction. At the wish of this good man in this house, Vimalakirti, come the innumerable Buddhas of the 10 directions. And when they come, they teach the gateway into the Dharma called the secrets of all the Buddhas, and then depart. And in this house, all the splendours of the abodes of the gods and all the splendours of the fields of the Buddhas shine forth in this house. So these are the 8 strange and wonderful things of Vimalakirti's house, which the goddess, this mysterious goddess, who in the course of the sutra has a very, very powerful effect on the proceedings before sort of vanishing. This is the sort of quality of the house. There's always a light shining. There's always the sound of the Dharma, which is heard in a kind of music. There's always the Buddhas coming in, teaching the secrets of the Buddhas. When you come into this house, you're not troubled by any defilements or anything like that. It's a place of marvels and wonders. So this is, I think, really what a Buddha field should be like. This is what really this house, this centre should be like. Perhaps you could even make your own house or flat or apartment something like that house through perhaps these 5 different precepts. So make yourself gather wisdom, make friends, make a world together, and revere the mystery.